The State Science Institute, too? Asked Fred Kennan. Oh, no, said Mooch. That's different. That's government. Besides, it's a non-profit institution. And it will be sufficient to take care of all scientific progress.
Quite sufficient, said Dr. Ferris.
And what will become of all the engineers, professors, and such when you close all those laboratories? Asked Fred Kennan. What are they going to do for a living, with all the other jobs and businesses frozen?
Oh, said Wesley Mooch. He scratched his head. He turned to Mr. Weatherby. Do we put them on relief, Clem?
No,
said Mr. Weatherby.
What for? There's not enough of them to raise a squawk. Not enough to matter.
I suppose, said Mooch, turning to Dr. Ferris, that you'll be able to absorb some of them, Floyd?
Some,
said Dr. Ferris slowly, as if relishing every syllable of his answer.
Those who prove cooperative.
What about the rest? Said Fred Kennan. They'll have to wait till the Unification Board finds some use for them, said Wesley Mooch.
What will they eat while they're waiting?
Mooch shrugged. There's got to be some victims in times of national emergency. It can't be helped.
We have the right to do it,
cried Taggart suddenly, in defiance to the stillness of the room.
We need it, don't we?
There was no answer.
We have the right to protect our livelihood.
Nobody opposed him, but he went on with a shrill, pleading insistence.
We'll be safe, for the first time in centuries. Everybody will know his place and job, and everybody else's place and job, and we won't be at the mercy of every stray crank with a new idea. Nobody will push us out of business, or steal our markets, or undersell us, or make us obsolete. Nobody will come to us offering some damn new gadget and putting us on the spot to decide whether we'll lose our shirt if we buy it, or whether we'll lose our shirt if we don't. But somebody else does. We won't have to decide. Nobody will be permitted to decide anything. It will be decided once and for all.
His glance moved pleadingly from face to face.
There's been enough invented already, enough for everybody's comfort. Why should they be allowed to go on inventing? Why should we permit them to blast the ground from under our feet every few steps? Why should we be kept on the go in eternal uncertainty, just because of a few restless, ambitious adventurers? Should we sacrifice the contentment of the whole of mankind to the greed of a few nonconformists? We don't need them. We don't need them at all. I wish we'd get rid of that hero worship. Heroes, they've done nothing but harm all through history. They've kept mankind running a wild race with no breathing spell, no rest, no ease, no security, running to catch up with them. Always, without end. Just as we catch up, they're years ahead. They leave us no chance. They've never left us a chance.
His eyes were moving restlessly. He glanced at the window, but looked hastily away. He did not want to see the white obelisk in the distance.
We're through with them. We've won. This is our age, our world. We're going to have security for the first time in centuries, for the first time since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, this, I guess, said Fred Kennan, is the anti-industrial revolution.
That's a damn funny thing for you to say, snapped Wesley Mooch. We can't be permitted to say that to the public.
Don't worry, brother, I won't say it to the public.
It's a total fallacy, said Dr. Ferris. It's a statement prompted by ignorance. Every expert has conceded long ago that a planned economy achieves the maximum of productive efficiency, and that centralization leads to super-industrialization.
Centralization destroys the blight of monopoly, said Boyle.
How's that again?
Drawled Kennan. Boyle did not catch the tone of mockery, and answered earnestly,
It destroys the blight of monopoly. It leads to the democratization of industry. It makes everything available to everybody. Now, for instance, at a time like this, when there's such a desperate shortage of iron ore, is there any sense in my wasting money, labor, and national resources on making old-fashioned steel, when there exists a much better metal that I could be making? A metal that everybody wants, but nobody can get. Now, is that good economics, or sound social efficiency, or democratic justice? Why shouldn't I be allowed to manufacture that metal, and why shouldn't the people get it when they need it, just because of the private monopoly of one selfish individual? Should we sacrifice our rights to his personal interests?
Skip it, brother, said Fred Kennan. I've read it all in the same newspapers you did.
I don't like your attitude, said Boyle,
in a sudden tone of righteousness, with a look which, in a barroom, would have signified a prelude to a fistfight. He sat up straight, buttressed by the columns of paragraphs on yellow-tinged paper, which he was seeing in his mind. At a time of crucial public need,
Are we to waste social effort on the manufacture of obsolete products? Are we to let the many remain in want while the few withhold from us the better products and methods available? Are we to be stopped by the superstitions of patent rights? Is it not obvious that private industry is unable to cope with the present economic crisis? How long, for instance, are we going to put up with the disgraceful shortage of Reardon metal? There is a crying public demand for it, which Reardon has failed to supply. When are we going to put an end to economic injustice and special privileges? Why should Reardon be the only one permitted to manufacture Reardon metal?
I don't like your attitude, said Orrin Boyle. So long as we respect the rights of the workers, we'll want you to respect the rights of the industrialists.
Which rights of which industrialists? Drawled Kennan.
I'm inclined to think, said Dr. Ferris hastily, that point two, perhaps, is the most essential one of all at present. We must put an end to that peculiar business of industrialists retiring and vanishing. We must stop them. It's playing havoc with our entire economy.
Why are they doing it? Asked Taggart nervously. Where are they all going?
Nobody knows, said Dr. Ferris. We've been unable to find any information or explanation, but it must be stopped. In times of crisis, economic service to the nation is just as much of a duty as military service. Anyone who abandons it should be regarded as a deserter. I have recommended that we introduce the death penalty for those men, but Wesley wouldn't agree to it.
Take it easy, boy, said Fred Kinnan, in an odd, slow voice.
He sat suddenly and perfectly still, his arms crossed, looking at Ferris in a manner that made it suddenly real to the room that Ferris had proposed murder.
Don't let me hear you talk about any death penalties in industry.
Dr. Ferris shrugged.
We don't have to go to extremes, said Mooch hastily. We don't want to frighten people. We want to have them on our side. Our top problem is, will they accept it at all?
They will, said Dr. Ferris.
I'm a little worried, said Eugene Lawson, about points three and four. Taking over the patents is fine. Nobody's going to defend industrialists. But I'm worried about taking over the copyrights. That's going to antagonize the intellectuals. It's dangerous. It's a spiritual issue. Doesn't point four mean that no new books are to be written or published from now on?
Yes, said Mooch, it does. But we can't make an exception for the book publishing business. It's an industry like any other. When we say no new products, it's got to mean no new products.
But this is a matter of the spirit, said Lawson. His voice had a tone not of rational respect, but of superstitious awe. We're not interfering with anybody's spirit, but when you print a book on paper, it becomes a material commodity, and if we grant an exception to one commodity, we won't be able to hold the others in line, and we won't be able to make anything stick.
Yes, that's true, but...
Don't be a chump, Jean, said Dr. Ferris. You don't want some recalcitrant hacks to come out with treatises that will wreck our entire program, do you? If you breathe the word censorship now, they'll all scream bloody murder. They're not ready for it. As yet. But if you leave the spirit alone and make it a simple material issue, not a matter of ideas, but just a matter of paper, ink, and printing presses, you accomplish your purpose much more smoothly. You'll make sure that nothing dangerous gets printed or heard, and nobody is going to fight over a material issue.
Yes, but I don't think the writers will like it.
Are you sure? Asked Wesley Mooch, with a glance that was almost a smile. Don't forget that under point five the publishers will have to publish as many books as they did in the basic year. Since there will be no new ones, they will have to reprint, and the public will have to buy some of the old ones. There are many very worthy books that have never had a fair chance.
Oh, said Lawson. He remembered that he had seen Mooch lunching with Balf Eubank 2 weeks ago. Then he shook his head and frowned. Still, I'm worried. The intellectuals are our friends. We don't want to lose them. They can make an awful lot of trouble.
They won't, said Fred Kinnan. Your kind of intellectuals are the first to scream when it's safe and the first to shut their traps at the first sign of danger. They spend years spitting at the man who feeds them, and they lick the hand of the man who slaps their drooling faces. Didn't they deliver every country of Europe one after another to committees of goons, just like this one here? Didn't they scream their heads off to shut out every burglar alarm and to break every padlock open for the goons? Have you heard a peep out of them since? Didn't they scream that they were the friends of labor? Do you hear them raising their voices about the chain gangs, the slave camps, the 14-hour workday, and the mortality from scurvy in the people's states of Europe? No. But you do hear them telling the whip-beaten wretches that starvation is prosperity, that slavery is freedom, that torture chambers are brother love, and that if the wretches don't understand it, then it's their own fault that they suffer. And it's the mangled corpses in the jail cellars who are to blame for all their troubles, not the benevolent leaders. Intellectuals. You might have to worry about any other breed of man, but not about the modern intellectuals. They'll swallow anything. I don't feel so safe about the lousiest wharf rat in the Longshoremen's Union. He's liable to remember suddenly that he's a man, and then I won't be able to keep him in line. But the intellectuals? That's the one thing they've forgotten long ago. I guess it's the one thing that all their education was aimed to make them forget. Do anything you please to the intellectuals. They'll take it.
For once, said Dr. Ferris, I agree with Mr. Kinnan. I agree with his facts, if not with his feelings. You don't have to worry about the intellectuals, Wesley. Just put a few of them on the government payroll and send them out to preach precisely the sort of thing Mr. Kinnan mentioned, that the blame rests on the victims. Give them moderately comfortable salaries and extremely loud titles, and they'll forget their copyrights and do a better job for you than whole squads of enforcement officers.
Yes, said Mooch. I know.
The danger that I'm worried about will come from a different quarter, said Dr. Ferris thoughtfully. You might run into quite a bit of trouble on that voluntary gift certificate business, Wesley.
I know, said Mooch glumly. That's the point I wanted Thompson to help us out on, but I guess he can't. We don't actually have the legal power to seize the patents. Oh, there's plenty of clauses in dozens of laws that can be stretched to cover it, almost, but not quite. Any tycoon who'd want to make a test case would have a very good chance to beat us, and we'd have to preserve a semblance of legality or the populace won't take it.
Precisely, said Dr. Ferris. It's extremely important to get those patents turned over to us voluntarily. Even if we had a law permitting outright nationalization, it would be much better to get them as a gift. We won't leave the people the illusion that they're still preserving their private property rights, and most of them will play along. They'll sign the gift certificates. Just raise a lot of noise about its being a patriotic duty and that anyone who refuses is a prince of greed, and they'll sign. But, he stopped.
I know, said Mooch. He was growing visibly more nervous. There will be, I think, a few old-fashioned bastards here and there who'll refuse to sign. But they won't be prominent enough to make a noise. Nobody will hear about it. Their own communities and friends will turn against them for their being selfish, so it won't give us any trouble. We'll just take the patents over anyway, and those guys won't have the nerve or the money to start a test case. But he stopped. James Taggart leaned back in his chair, watching them. He was beginning to enjoy the conversation.
Yes, said Dr. Ferris. I'm thinking of it, too. I'm thinking of a certain tycoon who is in a position to blast us to pieces. Whether we'll recover the pieces or not is hard to tell. God knows what is liable to happen at a hysterical time like the present, and in a situation as delicate as this. Anything can throw everything off balance. Blow up the whole works. And if there's anyone who wants to do it, he does. He does and can. He knows the real issue. He knows things which must not be said, and he is not afraid to say them. He knows the one dangerous, fatally dangerous weapon. He is our deadliest adversary.
Who? Asked Lawson.
Dr. Ferris hesitated, shrugged, and answered, The guiltless man. Lawson stared blankly.
What do you mean? And whom are you talking about?
James Taggart smiled. I mean that there is no way to disarm any man, said Dr. Ferris, except through guilt, through that which he himself has accepted as guilt. If a man has ever stolen a dime, you can impose on him the punishment intended for a bank robber, and he will take it. He'll bear any form of misery. He'll feel that he deserves no better. If there's not enough guilt in the world, we must create it. If we teach a man that it's evil to look at spring flowers, and he believes us, and then does it, we'll be able to do whatever we please with him. He won't defend himself. He won't feel he's worth it. He won't fight. But save us from the man who lives up to his own standards. Save us from the man of clean conscience. He's the man who'll beat us.
Are you talking about Henry Reardon?
Asked Taggart, his voice peculiarly clear. The one name they had not wanted to pronounce struck them into an instant silence.
What if I were? Asked Dr. Ferris cautiously.
Oh, nothing, said Taggart. Only if you were, I would tell you that I can deliver Henry Reardon. He'll sign.
By the rules of their unspoken language, they all knew, from the tone of his voice, that he was not bluffing.
God, Jim! No!
Gasped Wesley Mooch.
Yes, said Taggart. I was stunned, too, when I learned what I learned. I didn't expect that. Anything but that.
I am glad to hear it, said Mooch cautiously. It's a constructive piece of information. It might be very valuable indeed.
Valuable?
Yes, said Taggart pleasantly.
When do you plan to put the directive into effect?
Oh, we'll have to move fast. We don't want any news of it to leak out. I expect you all to keep this most strictly confidential. I'd say that we'll be ready to spring it on them in a couple of weeks.
Don't you think it would be advisable, before all prices were frozen, to adjust the matter of the railroad rates? I was thinking of a raise, a small but most essentially needed raise.
We'll discuss it, you and I, said Mooch amiably. It might be arranged. He turned to the others. Boyle's face was sagging. There are many details still to be worked out, but I'm sure that our program won't encounter any major difficulties. He was assuming the tone and manner of a public address. He sounded brisk and almost cheerful. Rough spots are to be expected. If one thing doesn't work, we'll try another. Trial and error is the only pragmatic rule of action. We'll just keep on trying. If any hardships come up, remember that it's only temporary, only for the duration of the national emergency.
Say, asked Kennan, how is the emergency to end if everything is to stand still?
Don't be theoretical, said Mooch impatiently. We've got to deal with the situation of the moment. Don't bother about minor details, so long as the broad outlines of our policy are clear. We'll have the power. We'll be able to solve any problem and answer any question.
Fred Kinnan chuckled.
Who is John Galt?
Don't say that, cried Taggart.
I have a question to ask about point 7, said Kinnan. It says that all wages, prices, salaries, dividends, profits, and so forth will be frozen on the date of the directive. Taxes, too?
Oh, no, cried Mooch. How can we tell what funds we'll need in the future? Kinnan seemed to be smiling. Well, snapped Mooch, what about it?
Nothing, said Kinnan. I just asked.
Mooch leaned back in his chair. I must say to all of you that I appreciate your coming here and giving us the benefit of your opinions. It has been very helpful. He leaned forward to look at his desk calendar and sat over it for a moment, toying with his pencil. Then the pencil came down, struck a date, and drew a circle around it. Directive 10-289 will go into effect on the morning of May 1st. All nodded approval. None looked at his neighbor. James Taggart rose, walked to the window, and pulled the blind down over the white obelisk. In the first moment of awakening, Dagny was astonished to find herself looking at the spires of unfamiliar buildings against a glowing pale blue sky. Then she saw the twisted seam of the thin stocking on her own leg. She felt a wrench of discomfort in the muscles of her waistline. And she realized that she was lying on the couch in her office, with the clock on her desk saying 6:15, and the first rays of the sun giving silver edges to the silhouettes of the skyscrapers beyond the window. The last thing she remembered was that she had dropped down on the couch, intending to rest for 10 minutes, when the window was black and the clock stood at 3:30. She twisted herself to her feet, feeling an enormous exhaustion. The lighted lamp on the desk looked futile in the glow of the morning, over the piles of papers which were her cheerless, unfinished task. She tried not to think of the work for a few minutes longer, while she dragged herself past the desk to her washroom and let handfuls of cold water run over her face. The exhaustion was gone by the time she stepped back into the office. No matter what night preceded it, she had never known a morning when she did not feel the rise of a quiet excitement that became a tightening energy in her body and a hunger for action in her mind. Because this was the beginning of day, and it was a day of her life, she looked down at the city. The streets were still empty. It made them look wider, and in the luminous cleanliness of the spring air, they seemed to be waiting for the promise of all the greatness that would take form in the activity about to pour through them. The calendar in the distance said, May 1st. She sat down at her desk, smiling in defiance at the distastefulness of her job. She hated the reports that she had to finish reading, but it was her job. It was her railroad. It was morning. She lighted a cigarette, thinking that she would finish this task before breakfast. She turned off the lamp
and pulled the papers forward. There were reports from the general managers of the four regions of the Taggart system, their pages a typewritten cry of despair over the breakdowns of equipment. There was a report about a wreck on the main line near Winston, Colorado. There was the new budget of the operating department, the revised budget, based on the raise in rates which Jim had obtained last week. She tried to choke the exasperation of hopelessness as she went slowly over the budget's figures. All those calculations had been made on the assumption that the volume of freight would remain unchanged, and that the raise would bring them added revenue by the end of the year. She knew that the freight tonnage would go on shrinking, that the raise would make little difference, that by the end of this year their losses would be greater than ever. When she looked up from the pages, she saw with a small jolt of astonishment that the clock said 9:25. She had been dimly aware of the usual sound of movement and voices in the anteroom of her office as her staff had arrived to begin their day. She wondered why nobody had entered her office, and why her telephone had remained silent. As a daily rule, there should have been a rush of business by this hour. She glanced at her calendar. There was a note that the McNeil Car Foundry of Chicago was to phone her at 9 a.m. in regard to the new freight cars, which Taggart Transcontinental had been expecting for 6 months. She flicked the switch of the interoffice communicator to call her secretary. The girl's voice answered with a startled little gasp. "Miss Taggart, are you here in your office?" "I slept here last night again. Didn't intend to, but did. Was there a call for me from the McNeil Car Foundry?"
"No, Miss Taggart."
"Put them through to me immediately when they call."
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
Switching the communicator off, she wondered whether she imagined it, or whether there had been something strange in the girl's voice. It had sounded unnaturally tense. She felt the faint lightheadedness of hunger, and thought that she should go down to get a cup of coffee. But there was still the report of the chief engineer to finish, so she lighted one more cigarette. The chief engineer was out on the road, supervising the reconstruction of the main track with the Reardon metal rail taken from the corpse of the John Galt line. She had chosen the sections most urgently in need of repair. Opening his report, she read, with a shock of incredulous anger, that he had stopped work in the mountain section of Winston, Colorado. He recommended a change of plans. He suggested that the rail intended for Winston be used instead to repair the track of their Washington to Miami branch. He gave his reasons. A derailment had occurred on that branch last week, and Mr. Tinky Holloway of Washington, traveling with a party of friends, had been delayed for 3 hours. It had been reported to the chief engineer that Mr. Holloway had expressed extreme displeasure. "Although from a purely technological viewpoint," said the chief engineer's report, "the rail of the Miami branch was in better condition than that of the Winston section, one had to remember from a sociological viewpoint that the Miami branch carried a much more important class of passenger traffic. Therefore, the chief engineer suggested that Winston could be kept waiting a little longer, and recommended the sacrifice of an obscure section of mountain trackage for the sake of a branch where Taggart Transcontinental could not afford to create an unfavorable impression." She read, slashing furious pencil marks on the margins of the pages, thinking that her first duty of the day ahead of any other was to stop this particular piece of insanity. The telephone rang. "Yes?" she asked, snatching the receiver. "McNeil Car Foundry?"
"No," said the voice of her secretary. "Signor Francisco D'Anconia."
She looked at the phone's mouthpiece for the instant of a brief shock.
"All right, put him on."
The next voice she heard was Francisco's. "I see that you're in your office just the same," he said. His voice was mocking, harsh, and tense.
"Where did you expect me to be?"
"How do you like the new suspension?"
"What suspension?"
"The moratorium on brains."
"What are you talking about?"
"Haven't you seen today's newspapers?"
"No."
There was a pause. Then his voice came slowly, changed, and grave.
"Better take a look at them, Dagny."
"All right.
I'll call you later."
She hung up and pressed the switch of the communicator on her desk. "Get me a newspaper," she said to her secretary.
"Yes, Miss Taggart," the secretary's voice answered grimly.
It was Eddie Willers who came in and put the newspaper down on her desk. The meaning of the look on his face was the same as the tone she had caught in Francisco's voice. The advance notice of some inconceivable disaster. None of us wanted to be first to tell you, he said very quietly, and walked out. When she rose from her desk a few moments later, she felt that she had full control of her body, and that she was not aware of her body's existence. She felt lifted to her feet, and it seemed to her that she stood straight, not touching the ground. There was an abnormal clarity about every object in the room, yet she was seeing nothing around her, but she knew that she would be able to see the thread of a cobweb if her purpose required it, just as she would be able to walk with a somnambulist's assurance along the edge of a roof. She could not know that she was looking at the room with the eyes of a person who has lost the capacity and the concept of doubt. And what remained to her was the simplicity of a single perception and of a single goal. She did not know that the thing which seemed so violent, yet felt like such a still, unfamiliar calm within her, was the power of full certainty, and that the anger shaking her body, the anger which made her ready with the same passionate indifference either to kill or to die, was her love of rectitude, the only love to which all the years of her life had been given. Holding the newspaper in her hand, she walked out of her office and on toward the hall. She knew, crossing the anteroom, that the faces of her staff were turned to her, but they seemed to be many years away. She walked down the hall, moving swiftly but without effort, with the same sensation of knowing that her feet were probably touching the ground, but that she did not feel it. She did not know how many rooms she crossed to reach Jim's office, or whether there had been any people in her way. She knew the direction to take and the door to pull open to enter unannounced and walk toward his desk. The newspaper was twisted into a roll by the time she stood before him. She threw it in his face. It struck his cheek and fell down to the carpet. "There's my resignation, Jim," she said. "I won't work as a slave or as a slave driver." She did not hear the sound of his gasp. It came with the sound of the door closing after her. She went back to her office and, crossing the anteroom, signaled Eddie to follow her inside. She said, her voice calm and clear, "I have resigned." He nodded silently. "I don't know as yet what I'll do in the future. I'm going away to think it over and to decide. If you want to follow me, I'll be at the lodge in Woodstock." It was an old hunting cabin in a forest of the Berkshire Mountains, which she had inherited from her father and had not visited for years. "I want to follow," he whispered. "I want to quit, and I can't. I can't make myself do it."
"Then will you do me a favor?"
"Of course."
"Don't communicate with me about the railroad. I don't want to hear it. Don't tell anyone where I am except Hank Reardon. If he asks, tell him about the cabin and how to get there, but no one else. I don't want to see anybody."
"All right. Promise?"
"Of course.
When I decide what's to become of me, I'll let you know."
"I'll wait."
"That's all, Eddie." He knew that every word was measured, and that nothing else could be said between them at this moment. He inclined his head, letting it say the rest, then walked out of the office. She saw the chief engineer's report still lying open on her desk, and thought that she had to order him at once to resume work on the Winston section, then remembered that it was not her problem any longer. She felt no pain. She knew that the pain would come later, and that it would be a tearing agony of pain, and that the numbness of this moment was a rest granted to her, not after but before, to make her ready to bear it. But it did not matter. "If that is required of me, then I'll bear it," she thought. She sat down at her desk and telephoned Reardon at his mills in Pennsylvania. "Hello, dearest," he said. He said it simply and clearly, as if he wanted to say it because it was real and right, and he needed to hold on to the concepts of reality and rightness.
"Hank, I've quit."
"I see." He sounded as if he had expected it. "Nobody came to get me, no destroyer. Perhaps there never was any destroyer after all. I don't know what I'll do next, but I have to get away so that I won't have to see any of them for a while. Then I'll decide. I know that you can't go with me right now." "No, I have 2 weeks in which they expect me to sign their gift certificate. I want to be right here when the 2 weeks expire."
"Do you need me for the 2 weeks?"
"No. It's worse for you than for me. You have no way to fight them,
I have. I think I'm glad they did it. It's clear and final. Don't worry about me. Rest. Rest from all of it first.
Yes.
Where are you going?